Okay. Let's get started. For those of you who did take the class, this is a little test to an opportunity for you guys to share what you know and to bring everyone else up to speed. How do you define apologetics? This is an apologetics class. So how is apologetics defined? What does it mean? Defending the faith, that's one part of the two-part answer. So I gave you a hint, there are two parts. One part is to defend and explain, to give a case. It comes from the Greek word apologia. And so it's not. I'm not going to go through some fancy ways to teach you how to be apologetic in the sense of saying sorry for being a Christian. But we're actually going to teach you and give you some tools that you can use to defend the Christian faith and to give a case for it. And so that's two sides to the same thing. And it comes from when Socrates was having to give a defense and a case for the way he had treated and taught the children of Athens or the youth of Athens. So he was given his apologetic, apologia. And so we are going to do that. And there are apologetics of other faiths. I think one of the most impressive apologetics outside of Christianity is the Muslim apologetic. Muslims are very, very good and crafty at defending their faith and giving a case for their faith. And so we have to be informed. We have to be engaged. And I would say this, and I say it somewhat lightly, but in my experience, the ones that are least skilled in their apologetic are atheists. I'd say atheists have a tendency to resort to childlike antics of name-calling and various things like that instead of giving a reasoned defense of their faith. Now, that's not to say that the professors and the atheistic teachers aren't gifted, but I would say people that are atheists usually don't know why they're atheists. So, apologetics, to give a defense and a case for something. And then another question is, what is the purpose of apologetics? Why do we do this? And basically, there are two main purposes or main reasons why apologetics is important for us as Christians.
To promote Christianity,
okay. To people who are sincerely seeking answers, it's definitely a way to promote and to give them a case. But what else?
Grow deeper in our own faith.
Grow in confidence, yeah. To grow deeper ourselves, to have more confidence in our faith. So now that we've kind of established a basis for this thing that we're doing called apologetics, some of the stuff that we covered last time where we started with the existence of God, and we went all the way through a defense of Christ's resurrection, and then we also went into discussing what faith is. And today, I want to start out by just kind of telling a story with youth group this past week. One of the questions that I brought up, and this is something that was talked about in the last apologetics class, was the nature of proof. That sometimes we're called as Christians, we're called on to give a proof that God exists. Prove to me God exists. Prove it. And oftentimes, what's confusing in that is what they mean by proof or prove. Because as I went on to discuss it at youth group, I asked them, because it was on the anniversary of September 11th, I asked them to prove to me that the Twin Towers had truly been attacked by terrorists. And so they went on to explain, well, we were alive when it happened. And I said, okay, so prove to me that it happened. Well, we saw it on the news. And I said, well, how do you know for sure that that wasn't just created? You watch movies all the time, TV series all the time. In fact, there's a movie that came out called Wag the Dog. Anyone ever heard of that? And the premise of that was there was a politician that needed his poll numbers to go up, and he knew a TV producer that produced basically a war on television and made the American people think that there really was a war, and his poll numbers went up because of it. And so it could be a fake, right? And so I said, the TV explanation is going to work for me. So prove to me that 9/11 actually happened. And when they said, well, I know somebody who was roommates with a guy's sister who in turn saw a photograph of somebody who was there. I said, okay, photographs can be altered. And then they went on to talk about magazine articles and newspaper, and all these people wouldn't be misled and they wouldn't be misleading intentionally about this event. I said, but at the end of the day, can you prove to me that the Twin Towers actually that attack took place? And they finally, in frustration, said, well, what do you mean by proof anyways? And I said, there we go. That's what you need to ask for at the very first. And so are people that are asking for God, the proof that God exists, are they asking for mathematical certainty? A lot of times, yeah. They're saying, I want physical evidence. And so the next question is, well, what would you accept as evidence? What would be satisfactory in your estimation? Would I need to produce the DNA of Jesus Christ in order for you to believe? Is that the evidence you're looking for? Because that's certainly not how people live their lives. And what we concluded was people primarily live their lives based on the testimony of other people and the observation of other people. That's what they form their reality around. We base it on our observation, which can be wrong. If I observe the moon, by my pure observation, I would think it's no bigger than my thumb. But my observation is wrong in that estimation. So we base our reality on our observation and the reliability of other people's observation most of the time. So why is it when it comes to God, we need mathematical certainty that He exists when we live the rest of our lives trusting in the testimony of other people? I make the joke that I've never seen a flamingo. Actually, it wasn't until a couple summers ago that I actually saw a flamingo. But I always knew and believed that they existed. But I had never personally experienced it, so I was trusting in National Geographic and other movies and other people that had seen flamingos before. And I trusted in those observations. And so we live our lives based on that. And so I guess the reason why I bring this up is because there's still the question out there, and this is based on an argument that came from the first class, but it was the first cause argument. You guys remember the first cause argument? Keith, explain what that is. Or if you just remember learning about it?
I remember some of the specifics about it. Just remember it having to do with what is existence can't create itself. It has to be something to create something. Out of nothing, nothing comes.
Okay. It involved infinite regress. Right. And we basically, when we look around the world, we don't see anything that hasn't caused itself, or that has caused itself. Everything is contingent. Okay? It's contingent upon something else for its existence. We see in the known world, everything we see and look at owes its cause to something else. And so there's this regress. Well, then we go back to what caused what caused that, what caused that, and we continue, and there can't be an infinite regress because we know by the second law of thermodynamics that the universe is dying. Okay? The universe is getting smaller. If it's getting smaller and eventually it's going to end, then it has a beginning. And so we realize that the universe has a cause because everything in the universe is caused. So then what caused the universe? And we say, well, that cause is God. God is the first cause, and that's why it's called the first cause argument. So the reason why I bring that up is because that's where we're going to start today, in the sense of, well, the question still remains, what caused God? If everything has a cause, philosophers are still asking the question, and atheists especially, what caused God? And has everyone in here heard of Bertrand Russell? Or anyone heard of Bertrand Russell? About 50 years ago, he came out with this book, and it's a collection of his essays, called Why I Am Not a Christian. And he was a British philosopher. And basically, what he sums up is in part of this is he says, I may say that when I was a young man and was debating these questions very seriously in my mind, the question of God and the first cause specifically, I for a long time accepted the argument of the first cause until one day at the age of 18, I read John Stuart Mill's autobiography and there I found this sentence, quote, my father taught me that the question, who made me, cannot be answered since it immediately suggests the further question, who made God? That very simple sentence showed me, as I still think, the fallacy in the argument of the first cause. If everything must have a cause, then God must have a cause. If there can be anything without a cause, it may just as well be the world as God, so that there cannot be any validity in that argument at all. And so he says, well, if everything has a cause, then what caused God? And you think, well, that was 50 years ago. Well, then, have you guys heard of Richard Dawkins? Mm-hmm. He's kind of the prominent atheist of today. He's also a British philosopher. Actually, he's a biologist. And he just came out with a book almost 50 years to the day as Bertrand Russell's book called The God Delusion. And he says, and he's speaking of basically the first cause argument, to return to the infinite regress and the futility of invoking God to terminate it, it is more parsimonious to conjure up, say, a Big Bang singularity or some other physical concept as yet unknown. Calling it God is at best unhelpful and at worst perniciously misleading. Okay, he talks about the recipe for a certain beef cutlet. Invites us to procure some strips of beef, and having cut them into the smallest possible pieces, proceed to cut them still smaller. And what he basically talks about is you could infinitely divide something. That was used to be a theory, that infinite regress, you could continue to divide something into smaller and smaller pieces. But what he found is that you can't, at some point, subatomic level, you can't divide it any longer. And so why do we call that Adam, God, when it's simply just an atom? And so he says the first cause argument is still insufficient. So, we're going to look at that. If you open to your first page, actually page 2, after the table of contents, we're going to get into this concept. And this is where we're going to start today. How many of you think, wow, this is the way that the words being used in the talking is kind of over my head or out of my league, and this is going to be a rough class? Anybody? That's okay, because the first 3 times I took this class, I thought that. So, I think what can
There's
give
no
you hope,
tests.
Though, what's that?
There's no tests.
There are no tests. And so, I think what we're going to get to and some of the things that we're going to cover here are going to make a lot of sense. So, I don't want to intimidate you, but I think the language and the way that we talk about things, you'll eventually get used to it. For instance, there's an apologist named Ravi Zacharias. Have you guys heard of him? It takes me about 10 minutes just listening to him until I can finally understand what he's saying through his accent. And so I think that's maybe what can happen here. I don't know. So, what caused God? Which is a legitimate question that's still being asked today. If everything that exists has caused, then what caused God, or what did God come from? If it is thought that everything has a cause, but it turns out God doesn't have a cause, then the idea that everything has a cause is false. Right? Because then we can't say everything has a cause. Right? If there's something that doesn't have a cause. The question may be sincere, or it may be attempting to create a contradiction. It is important to clarify what is meant by God. The first thing that is meant by God is an eternal being, and therefore a being without cause. Now, when we say eternal, what do we mean?
No beginning, no end.
Something without beginning or end. I think of it, if I had a marker here, but a line with 2 arrows, right? An arrow on each side, meaning it goes on that way and that way forever. So something without a beginning and without an end. So to require a cause for God is to ask, what caused an uncaused being? Okay, we're going to start delving into the absurdity here. And this is simply to show that the question itself, what caused God, is a poor question. Okay? So to require a cause for God is to ask, what caused an uncaused being? Now, by definition, this is impossible, because something which is eternal has no beginning and therefore no cause. Therefore, the question, what caused God, is what is called a categorical fallacy. Categorical fallacy. You guys need me to spell that?
Yes.
I would. Okay, we're going to unpack what a categorical fallacy is, because that's pretty crucial to understanding this argument. Categorical fallacy. Everyone tracking so far? Great. To commit this fallacy is to ascribe a characteristic or attribute to something which it is not possible for that thing to possess. Okay? To commit this fallacy is to ascribe a characteristic or attribute to something which it is not for that thing to possess. It involves a misunderstanding of the nature of something. For example, red is a prime number. Red is a prime number. That is a categorical fallacy. Okay? So the question, what caused God, is similar to asking, and I'll give you 3 other examples. What color is the number 5? That's a categorical fallacy, right? It's ascribing a character attribute to something which it is not possible for that thing to possess. What is the taste of yellow? What is the shape of a C note? Actual musical wave. How high is that? Okay. When I was In high school, I was a part of a JROTC, Junior Reserve Officer Training Corps, and the drill instructor would constantly remind us of how dumb we were, and how out of line we were. And so sometimes he would, if we were standing in formation and we were really in a crooked line or something, he would say, "You're more messed up than a football bat."
Football bat.
Or you're more messed up than a soup sandwich. And you and me, I'm kind of analytical, so I'm sitting there thinking, trying to picture a soup sandwich. And those are what are considered to be catagolicy. So what we're saying here is the question, "What caused God?" is a poor question, because it's attributing or ascribing a characteristic to something that it is impossible for that thing to have, which is an uncaused being cannot have a cause by definition. Okay, the question is misguided. It assumes everything must be contingent, a contingent entity, that there can be no such thing as a self-existent and uncaused entity like God. There must be something which has always existed and is eternal. And I just want to share this with you. This is basically a book of response, I think unintentionally, but a book of response to Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion. This is a book by a guy named Dinesh D'Souza. I don't know if you've heard of any of his other stuff. He wrote a book also called What's So Great About America. But this is called What's So Great About Christianity. And it's not a negative statement. He's actually saying a positive thing. What's so great about Christianity is the following. Actually got stopped in an airport for having his other book, What's So Great About America. They thought I was a terrorist. So anyway, that's a whole other story. And he says, the real force of Aquinas' argument, because Aquinas, Thomas Aquinas, coined the first cause argument. He says, the real force of Aquinas' argument, however, is not that every series must have a beginning, but that every series, in order to have a being or existence, must depend on something outside the series. It is no rebuttal to say that as everything must have a cause, who caused God? Aquinas' argument does not use the premise that everything needs a cause, only that everything that exists in the universe needs a cause. Okay.
Did you say that
again? Aquinas' argument does not use the premise that everything needs a cause, only that everything that exists in the universe needs a cause. Okay? Everything that exists in the universe needs. The movement and contingency of the world cannot be without some ultimate explanation. Since God is by definition outside the universe, he is not a part of the series. Therefore, the rules of the series, including the rules of causation, would not logically apply to him. And this is where it gets really good. Think of God as the author of a novel. The events in the narrative have a certain coherence and logic. Something that occurs in the beginning of the story causes a crisis for one of the characters in the middle of the story. Okay? And he talks about a character in Crime and Punishment causes the death of the old woman. But the author is the cause of the story, and on an entirely different level. The rules of causation that apply within the novel do not apply to its creator. It makes sense to ask of a character that suddenly appears, where did he come from? How did you account for him? It makes no sense, context, however, to ask, where did the author come from of the novel? How do you account for him? The author is outside the narrative, outside of the story. And his act of creation cannot be understood as an episode within it. From this discussion, it should be evident that Harris and Dawkins have not even come close to answering Aquinas' argument. Okay. Does that make sense? That really put legs on it for me, that the reality of this question and how absurd it is like asking the author of some novel, The Shack, for instance. Have you all heard of The Shack? It's a new popular book, or what's a famous book? The Animal Farm. It's like asking in The Animal Farm where the pigs came from, and then also with the same legitimacy asking where George Orwell came from and how is it that he even came up with this story. Okay, in the context, George Orwell stands out of the narrative. He stands outside of the story. So the rules that apply to the story in itself don't apply to him. He made it. So he makes the rules in the story. Right? Does that make sense? So God is outside of the series. And so here's the point that we're going to make. And this is the point that they're missing with Aquinas. However, this reveals that not everything which exists has a cause. An eternal being is by nature non-contingent, so it does not need a cause. If the universe began, then its cause must exist prior to and separate from it. Therefore, in order to be specific, the initial statement should be, whatever begins to exist must have a cause. Not whatever exists has a cause, but whatever begins to exist, whatever has a beginning, has a cause. Right? And we look around, and that means everything in the universe has a beginning, with the exception of God. So whatever begins to exist has a cause. And we know that, and that can be repeated. You could put that under the scientific method, and it would come out 100% of the time. Everything that begins to exist has a cause. Something caused its beginning. Okay? All right. So what is meant by God? That which is eternal is uncaused, and therefore must be the first cause. To be the initial cause of everything requires the cause to be quite powerful. To use that power to create intricately requires intelligence. That which is intelligent is also personal. So God is a personal being existing eternally with the power and intelligence to create the universe. Okay, so realistically, has anyone ever been approached with this question? I never have been personally, but when I read and various things like that, that question comes up. And it's usually only the academics, the atheistic professors that try to come after things like this. But when you talk to everyone else, it seems to make a lot of sense. Talk about everything in the universe has a cause. So by infinite regress, we have to go back. If, you know, the whole idea of, well, I was caused by my parents, they were caused by their parents, they were caused by their parents, and you go back, when does it end? Right? If everything has a cause in the universe, then when does it end? And you go all the way back, and you're like, well, it goes back to Adam and Eve. And then the question, what caused them? Or trees, you know, it came from a seed of another, came from a seed of another tree. And you go back, and infinite regress, there isn't, you can't. Because everything has a cause in the known universe. Everything that exists in the known universe.
I think the reason it doesn't work is because everything is creation. And if you go all the way back to the first tree, but the tree didn't make the man.
Right.
And the rock didn't make the rock. And we're talking about something that's not of earth. You can't define meat, and get something that's not meat.
Right. It's not a part of the series. It can't be. I'm getting a lot of blank stares.
Clear as mud.
I don't want that.
I like that often. That helps you to understand the concept.
Okay.
I think it makes a real good argument. Because when they have come back with something to counter that, mm-hmm. What do you do? Where do you go? Mm-hmm.
That's a great analogy, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's even says so in the Bible. He says God is the author of whatever.
He is the author, yeah. The author of creation.
Yeah, and that's why he stated in the Bible.
It does make sense.
Why we didn't use that analogy before, I don't know.
Okay. But you guys, this is all settling pretty well. Dustin, how are we doing? You're about 50 minutes into your day, and you're getting this kind of stuff. You all right? It's like a strong cup of coffee. Okay, there you go. Kelly, you tracking? Making sense? Okay. Are you making your dad take notes?
I have to go to school tomorrow.
Oh. Okay. Well, that's all that I planned today because I anticipated more questions. And I think it's a pretty good start, a pretty good jump start. And we're normally going to start probably at 8:45, okay? I know it says 8:30, but Ed's just praying by 8:30 in his class, and I don't want to rush that. And so we'll give a little leeway there for people to show up. And I guarantee we'll be done before 10 every time. So,
Keith. Fire some questions at you then.
Okay.
What of those who segue into the argument of evolution?
Okay, Keith said, what of those who segue into the argument of evolution? I'm repeating.
Thanks.
Otherwise, they can't hear. Well,
I guess my question is
specifically to what?
Well, they can then regress into, well, it goes back to the first man. Okay, well, then maybe man was a mutation of the ape, and they go all the way back to the first single cell organism.
What?
That came from the Big Bang. That was.
That in philosophy is called begging the question. Okay, and it's interesting. It's called begging the question. Okay, you're just removing it one step so you don't have to answer it. Okay, so they're saying, well, yeah, man wasn't caused by God as a mutation from the ape. Okay, then you go, well, then what caused the ape?
Right.
Because the ape is a caused being. It has a beginning. So then they say, well, the ape came from a squid. Okay, what caused the squid? Well, then the squid came from a smaller little single-cell organism floating around in primordial soup. Okay, well, then what caused the little thing, and what caused the primordial soup? Well, now what they're saying is aliens. Literally, so they're suggesting aliens came to the planet and left a little primordial soup. And that started that. That begs a question, right? Then you ask, what caused the aliens? What caused their planet? What caused their existence? Okay? It just begs the question, and it doesn't remove this idea. Because we know, by scientific method, we're using their tools, okay, to prove that everything that exists in the universe has a cause. Okay, God outside of the universe is outside of the story. He's the author of the story. So he, therefore, doesn't... The rules of the universe don't apply to him because he's outside of it. Okay, so that's how I would address that. I'd just say, okay, well then... And I'd play along for a little bit.
Sure.
I'd play along and say, okay, apes. Well, then what caused the apes? I'd kind of do the Columbo method.
Right.
You know, or you just kind of... well then, and you're just sincerely asking them questions. What caused the ape? Then what caused the suit? Then what caused the aliens?
So as to eventually get to a point to where they're just kind of sitting there speechless, whereas you can go in and say, well, this is really what's going on.
Right. Because with apologetics, our goal is never to use a sledgehammer to pound ideas into their head. We use crowbars. Okay? We open their minds up by asking questions, and the right kind of questions, so that they can start to see for themselves their own ideas laid out before them, and they can go, that's... kind of absurd.
And I guess in what I've always found is a non-believer that questions, the question is so huge that it's like, where do I start to answer outside of life with a question? But
and sometimes that's intentional. Mm-hmm. They want to dissuade you. They don't want you to try.
But I think partly because of the instant society we live in, they expect an instant answer that can make them just be a believer. But that general huge question is like the stars in the sky. It's just,
Well, and this is something we talked about before that we can get into again. That's actually... anybody got a Kleenex? Oh, here we go.
Watch out for the donut shirt.
Okay. No, and this is good because this is a refresher too. But in approaching somebody who is opposed to the gospel, there's basically, as an apologist, because now that you are in apologetics class, you are all Christian apologists, by the way. Okay, you're all Christian philosophers. And so, as a good Christian apologist, you have a responsibility that when you're talking with a sincere seeker, someone who wants to know truth, or even if they're not sincere and they have a lot of questions, it's important to identify what are their key barriers to the gospel. Okay? And we do that because there's three major categories or basic categories that everything can be funneled into. Do you guys remember these? Anybody? The three barriers to the gospel? It's good we're reviewing. Okay, the first one, they may have intellectual barriers. Second one, emotional barriers. And third one, willful. Okay. So, examples of intellectual barriers to the gospel may be God's existence, right?
Christ's resurrection.
Resurrection, yeah. the problem of evil. You know, they look at the hurricane that just hit Texas and they go, how could an all-powerful, all-loving God let something like that happen? Those people didn't do anything to deserve it. And you think about that statement about the nature of man, and you go, well. But there's some other intellectual barriers. It may be they don't believe in non-physical things. They think they're physicalist or materialist. They think all existence, all reality is purely physical. There's no such thing as a non-physical thing or a supernatural existence. Various other intellectual things. They just can't get themselves to, they don't understand or it doesn't work for them. Emotional barriers would be maybe they were wronged by the church. Maybe they had an experience with a Christian that really turned them off and just really left a bad taste in their mouth, and they just don't want to become like that. Maybe they see something in Christians they don't like and they don't want to be associated with those people. A bad experience with a pastor, or maybe they were abused by a dad who was Christian or a relative that was Christian. And that, you know, there's all kinds of emotional barriers. For me, and I've shared this story before, one of my senior thesis classes in college was with, I was a philosophy major, so there was a lot of different worldviews represented in that room. And one of them was a guy named Josh, and he was an adamant atheist. He was a very aggressive atheist. He liked to find Christians and then, you know, just pester them and ask them questions until they kind of gave up. And that was his favorite thing to do, was just go after Christians. And so as we were sitting in class, we were talking, and we got into kind of infinite regress. We got into first cause stuff, and we were talking about God's existence. And as I'm trying to respond to some of his questioning throughout the course that semester, I was playing Frisbee with one of his buddies from high school. And it turns out that his dad was also an adamant atheist like he was. And his dad had passed away 2 years prior to him going to college or something like that. And so the reality of the situation, as I looked at it, I said, you know, it's highly likely that he knows that if he believes in God, he has to believe that his dad is in hell. That's an uncomfortable thought. No fun. And so although he had a lot of intellectual stuff going on the surface, this was a big one underneath, an emotional barrier to the gospel. And then there's also willful barriers, and this is one that can't be touched by us. People know the gospel. They have no problems with Christ's resurrection. They have no problems with God's existence. They think it all sounds great. Maybe they grew up in the church. But really, they like sin. They don't want to stop sinning. Or maybe they don't want to relinquish control. They like controlling their life, seemingly. They like to think that they have their hands on the reins. And so giving up that is just not a fun idea. And so, Rhonda, to kind of approach your question, is sometimes they ask big questions, and it's important for you to kind of step back and not immediately respond, but maybe prayerfully consider what's really going on. Is it truly an intellectual thing, and they're really struggling with God's existence, and will they sincerely listen to some reasoning that I give?
I see a little bit of each one individual.
A lot of times, it's really this one. And these are kind of buffers. We had an experience at Oregon State in an apologetics class similar to this. And there was this girl named Bex. She showed up, and she was just a straight-up grunge hippie type of girl. I mean, she like had just knots and dreads in her hair, and just bathing and shaving and those type of things were not something she enjoyed. And so, and I can say this because she's a friend of mine now, but she came and she heard about this apologetics class, and as we were going through stuff, she would ask all these questions, and she was constantly asking questions of our teacher, and it was just kind of the point, eventually it was just like, she was just trying to be distracting in our class, but she legitimately had a bunch of questions, and what if, what about this, what about this, and just continued to go after these questions through the whole course of the semester, and by the end of it, Dwayne, our teacher, had addressed pretty much every intellectual problem she had brought up. And she also had a friend who was in the class that was in her sorority with her. And the friend was a really close friend, and she had also a bunch of emotional barriers. There were different things going back to her family and her grandparents and just some stuff going on there. And her friend was able to kind of address some of those and talk about her with those. And, you know, she was really working through some of that stuff. And then it finally came down at the end. She just didn't want to be a Christian. She just didn't want to. She had no emotional hang-ups anymore. She had no intellectual hang-ups anymore. And to hear her tell the story is pretty phenomenal. But she was just walking one afternoon, and she just kind of was there and just realized, it's just purely I don't want to. And God broke her. And he completely broke her, and she came falling at his feet, and she's born again. And it's just a really cool story. And so I think that's a good reminder to us, you know, what is the role of apologetics in witnessing, and what are the limits to it?
Okay, we went to Israel one time with a Christian group, and our guide came on the bus, and the very first thing he said was, don't try to proselytize me. I've heard everything. I'm perfectly happy in my Judaism. And as we went on the tour, this guy knew more about Christianity than probably 99% of Christians. And he simply did not want to be a Christian. He was the willful, or maybe the spiritual barrier where the Holy Spirit hadn't hit him. But, and I said, well, how do you know so much about Christianity and not want to be one? And he said, well, I just am very happy with what I believe and where I am. And the guy was phenomenal in his knowledge. He had no intellectual barriers. If the Lord knew.
And sometimes with those Middle Eastern cultures, I mean, it's so tied in the family that sometimes to change.
This guy was from Milwaukee.
Okay, never mind that. I know that's a big issue for Muslims. If you leave the Muslim faith, then you have rejected your family more than you've rejected God. Like you've brought shame on your family that's unheard of. And so that's a huge deal for them. But the guy from Milwaukee, not so much.
He was perfectly happy.
Yeah. Content, yeah. So, yeah, and just a reminder, the limits, evidence doesn't save anybody. Arguments don't save anybody. It's the power and the Holy Spirit of God that transforms hearts. Sometimes we get to be a vessel. We get to be a conduit for God's reasoning. And we can address things, and God puts us in the right place and brings to memory some of this stuff. And we can give a case and a defense, and I think that's very evident in the case of Paul all through the book of Acts. Many times he is called upon to give a case for Christ, the first Christian apologist by far. So, besides Jesus. Kelly, did you have a question? Okay, I thought I saw you raise your hand. What's that? Pondering. Oh, okay. That's deep thought. Yeah, and when I ask a question, if it's silent, I'm going to assume you're thinking. I'm just going to give you the benefit of the doubt, okay? I'll just assume that you're thinking about it, and I'll wait. It would be a good assignment, just to read through. And something that I did several years ago is just track through the missionary journeys of Paul. You know, identify when he's giving a case for Christ and he's defending the faith. And there are two distinct things, because sometimes he's in front of a group of people and he's presenting a case for Christ. And he's talking to Gentile people that why Christ is the Messiah, why Christ is God. And there are other times when he's under trial and he's defending the faith against accusations of Pharisees or Roman officials. And so it's just cool to track that. He was the true Christian apologist. He was constantly in a mode of, I can either give a case for Christ right now, or I can defend him. One of the two is always an option for me.
So did he ever come upon somebody like Ed and said he came across, or they were just happy where they were? Is there a story?
Usually Paul was so persuasive that was neither. He either caused them to hate him or to love him. He never really had people like, oh, that's interesting. Let's keep walking, huh?
But you know, it was never like, exactly like that.
With Jesus. Well, no, he wasn't content. He was disappointed because he knew it's either follow this guy and give up all my stuff.
So he was more content with his stuff.
I think there was a lot of conflict in his heart. Yeah, I don't think he was kind of...
Well, Mars Hill, though, they said, you know, oh, that's interesting. You'd like
interesting
to
philosophy.
Yeah,
come back. Yeah, share with us. These are interesting.
It could be a blow-off, too.
Yeah, it could be. Just given to the nature of that culture where they were philosophers that liked new ideas and liked to kind of weigh in. But
well, in Acts 25 with Agrippa.
There we go.
Festus.
Yeah, Festus.
Mm-hmm. I mean, at the end, they kind of walked out and said, that was interesting.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't think we know the whole of the story.
No, but
and I think Festus was left with some interesting questions.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's a pretty interesting scenario. That's a good one to read. Is it a good joke?
I say, like, why did my parents name me Festus?
Right. For those of you in the listening audience, Ed made a joke. And he said that the question he was leaving with was, why did my parents name me Festus? I wanted that to be on record. Okay. Anything else? Okay, I think this is a good start. You can read ahead if you think it's going to help. I'm just saying. There are a lot of blanks there, though. And again, if you miss these, I'm going to somehow, some way try to get every one of these recorded. So if you need to be out of town, that's fine. Just listen in on the website. Just go to the sermons link on our webpage, and it should be listed there, Apologetics 2. And you can download those, put them on your iPod or your cell phone now.